Chapter 56. These three fell 4/5 of a mile, and their bodies were afterward found, lying side by side, upon a glacier, whence they were borne to Zermatt and buried in the churchyard. The remains of Lord Douglas have never been found. The secret of his sepulture, like that of Moses, must remain a mystery always. A walk from St. Nicholas to Zermatt is a wonderful experience. Nature is built on a stupendous plan in that region. One marches continually between walls that are piled into the skies, with their upper heights broken into a confusion of sublime shapes that gleam white and cold against the background of blue, and here and there one sees a big glacier displaying its grandeurs on the top of a precipice, or a graceful cascade leaping and flashing down the green declivities. There is nothing tame, or cheap, or trivial, it is all magnificent. That short valley is a picture gallery of a notable kind, for it contains no mediocrities. From end to end the Creator has hung it with his masterpieces. We made Zermatt at 3 in the afternoon, 9 hours out from St. Nicholas. Distance, by guidebook, 12 miles, by pedometer 72. We were in the heart and home of the mountain climbers now, as all visible things testified. The snow peaks did not hold themselves aloof, an aristocratic reserve. They nestled close around, in a friendly sociable way. Guides, with the ropes and axes and other implements of their fearful calling slung about their persons, roosted in a long line upon a stone wall in front of the hotel, and waited for customers. Sunburned climbers, in mountaineering costume, and followed by their guides and porters, arrived from time to time, from breakneck expeditions among the peaks and glaciers of the High Alps, male and female tourists, on mules, filed by, in a continuous procession, hotelward bound from wild adventures which would grow in grandeur very time they were described at the English or American fireside, and at last, outgrow the possible itself. We were not dreaming. This was not a make-believe home of the Alp climber, created by our heated imaginations. No, for here was Mr. Girdlestone himself, the famous Englishman who hunts his way to the most formidable Alpine summits without a guide. I was not equal to imagining a Girdlestone. It was all I could do to even realize him, while looking straight at him at short range. I would rather face whole wide parks of artillery than the ghastly forms of death which he has faced among the peaks and precipices of the mountains. There is probably no pleasure equal to the pleasure of climbing a dangerous Alp, but it is a pleasure which is confined strictly to people who can find pleasure in it. I have not jumped to this conclusion. I have traveled to it per gravel train, so to speak. I have thought the thing all out, and am quite sure I am right. A born climber's appetite for climbing is hard to satisfy. When it comes upon him, he is like a starving man with a feast before him. He may have other business on hand, but it must wait. Mr. Girdlestone had had his usual summer holiday in the Alps, and had spent it in his usual way, hunting for unique chances to break his neck. His vacation was over, and his luggage packed for England, but all of a sudden a hunger had come upon him to climb the tremendous Weisshorn once more, for he had heard of a new, and utterly impossible route up it. His baggage was unpacked at once, and now he and a friend, laden with knapsacks, ice axes, coils of rope, and canteens of milk, were just setting out. They would spend the night high up among the snows, somewhere, and get up at 2 in the morning, and finish the enterprise. I had a strong desire to go with them, but forced it down a feat which Mr. Girdlestone, with all his fortitude, could not do. Even ladies catch the climbing mania, and are unable to throw it off. A famous climber, of that sex, had attempted the Weisshorn a few days before our arrival, and she and her guides had lost their way in a snowstorm high up among the peaks and glaciers, and been forced to wander around a good while before they could find a way down. When this lady reached the bottom, she had been on her feet 23 hours. Our guides, hired on the Gemmi, were already at Zermatt when we reached there. So there was nothing to interfere with our getting up an adventure, whenever we should choose the time and the object. I resolved to devote my first evening in Zermatt to studying up the subject of alpine climbing, by way of preparation. I read several books, and here are some of the things I found out. One's shoes must be strong and heavy, and have pointed hobnails in them. The alpenstock must be of the best wood, for if it should break, loss of life might be the result. One should carry an axe, to cut steps in the ice with, on the great heights. There must be a ladder, for there are steep bits of rock which can be surmounted with this instrument or this utensil but could not be surmounted without it. Such an obstruction has compelled the tourist to waste hours hunting another route, when a ladder would have saved him all trouble. One must have from 150 to 500 feet of strong rope, to be used in lowering the party down steep declivities which are too steep and smooth to be traversed in any other way. One must have a steel hook, on another rope a very useful thing, for when one is ascending, and comes to a low bluff which is yet too high for the ladder, he swings this rope aloft like a lasso, the hook catches at the top of the bluff, and then the tourist climbs the rope, hand over hand, being always particular to try, and forget, that if the hook gives way he will never stop falling till he arrives in some part of Switzerland, where they are not expecting him. Another important thing, there must be a rope, to tie the whole party together with, so that if one falls from a mountain, or down a bottomless chasm in a glacier, the others may brace back on the rope and save him. One must have a silk veil, to protect his face from snow, sleet, hail, and gale, and colored goggles to protect his eyes from that dangerous enemy, snow blindness. Finally, there must be some porters, to carry provisions, wine and scientific instruments, and also blanket bags for the party to sleep in. I closed my readings with a fearful adventure which Mr. Whymper once had on the Matterhorn, when he was prowling around alone, 5,000 feet above the town of Braille. He was edging his way gingerly around the corner of a precipice, where the upper edge of a sharp declivity of ice-glazed snow joined it. This declivity swept down a couple of hundred feet, into a gully which curved around, and ended at a precipice 800 feet high, overlooking a glacier. His foot slipped, and he fell. He says, "My knapsack brought my head down first, and I pitched into some rocks about a dozen feet below. They caught something, and tumbled me off the edge, head over heels, into the gully. The baton was dashed from my hands, and I whirled downward in a series of bounds, each longer than the last, now over ice, now into rocks, striking my head four or five times, each time with increased force. The last bound sent me spinning through the air in a leap of 50 or 60 feet, from one side of the gully to the other, and I struck the rocks, luckily, with the whole of my left side. They caught my clothes for a moment, and I fell back onto the snow with motion arrested. My head fortunately came the right side up, and a few frantic catches brought me to a halt, in the neck of the gully, and on the verge of the precipice. Baton, hat, and veil skimmed by and disappeared, and the crash of the rocks which I had started as they fell onto the glacier, told how narrow had been the escape from utter destruction. As it was, I fell nearly 200 feet in 7 or 8 bounds. 10 feet more would have taken me in one gigantic leap of 800 feet onto the glacier below. The situation was sufficiently serious. The rocks could not be let go for a moment, and the blood was spurting out of more than 20 cuts. The most serious ones were in the head, and I vainly tried to close them with one hand, while holding on with the other. It was useless. The blood gushed out in blinding jets at each pulsation. At last, in a moment of inspiration, I kicked out a big lump of snow, and struck it as plaster on my head. The idea was a happy one, and the flow of blood diminished. Then, scrambling up, I got, not a moment too soon, to a place of safety, and fainted away. The sun was setting when consciousness returned, and it was pitch dark before the great staircase was descended. But by a combination of luck and care, the whole 4,700 feet of descent to Braille was accomplished without a slip, or once missing the way. His wounds kept him abed some days. Then he got up and climbed that mountain again. That is the way with a true Alp climber. The more fun he has, the more he wants. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.